ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
But first, to some breaking news. Authorities are currently responding to reports of an active shooter at Bondi Beach in Sydney's east. Police say officers are responding to an incident there and are urging people to avoid the area.
Clearly, there are people badly injured. It's not clear exactly what's happened at this stage.
This is a targeted attack on Jewish Australians on the first day of Hanukkah, which should be a day of joy, a celebration of faith. An act of evil anti-Semitism, terrorism, that has struck the heart of our nation.
I just want to pay my respects to everybody, but to Australia and the Prime Minister, to everybody that we know so well, we get along with so well. We have a great relationship. That's a terrible situation going on over there.
I mean, we've been fearing something like this, what's going to happen for ages, and it's actually happened.
I'm afraid for my brother and my sisters and their children. But personally, no, I'm not afraid. I'm sad, but I'm not afraid.
As we heard there, Australia's Jewish community is a strong, close-knit group that's resilient in the face of adversity. The Jewish community is small, with roughly 120,000 living in Australia, many gathered in city hubs. The effects of the Bondi shooting has been felt deeply by all Jewish Australians, including those living thousands of kilometres away.
You question your safety purely because of your religious beliefs, and it's not something we ever thought we would say here in Australia. For us, who we may be, you know, 1,000 kilometres away, but we feel that impact greatly.
Ash Shankar, who lives with his family in Upper Coomera on the Gold Coast of Queensland. For many Jewish people living in regional Australia, there may not be a synagogue to turn to for solace. Today in Australia-wide, the regional response to the shooting at Bondi Beach. I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia-wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. Australia's Jewish community is reeling after the events that unfolded at Hanukkah celebrations at Bondi Beach. At least 15 people have died, including a 10-year-old girl, and one of the gunmen has also died. More than 40 people have also been taken to hospital. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has labelled the attack as an act of pure evil, an act of terror, and an act of anti-Semitism. Rabbi Aaron is from a community organisation, Chabad, that offers outreach to Jewish communities in rural and regional Australia. Firstly, Rabbi, how are you going?
It's been a very, very hectic and difficult day. Just keeping up with everybody that's been reaching out to people ourselves. And of course, dealing with the media, which comes along with an event like this.
No doubt difficult and talking about it difficult. So I appreciate you chatting to Australia Wide. The events we saw at Bondi has shocked everyone and all Australians, but I'd imagine the impact is deeply felt by Jewish people living in regional Australia. Even though they're 1,000 kilometres away, that's their community. What have they been telling you about it?
Yeah, so people are just really reeling from seeing something like this happening, you know, on our doorstep in Australia. Not something they're expecting to see over here. But at the same time, people are really coming together. And I've seen some really incredible expressions of support that people have passed on to myself, and people have been communicating between each other, which is really heartwarming to see. But yeah, it's a terribly, terribly tragic event. I myself personally know quite a few of the victims and quite a few of the families of the victims. And we're really just trying to process all of this and figure out how we can move forward.
One of the people who died was a close friend of yours, Rabbi Eli Schlanger. Can you tell us about the work he did?
Yes, Rabbi Schlanger was a real gem of a man, a really incredible, incredible person. He wore a number of different hats. He was part of the team at the Chabad Bondi, which is the synagogue there in Bondi on O'Brien Street. And also he was involved in a lot of personal outreach work. And he also worked as a chaplain for the prison system. So he would travel all over regional New South Wales and ended up in Lithgow and Grafton and the South Coast visiting Jewish people that are incarcerated in the prison system. And that's where a lot of times our paths crossed, where he would be out in a regional area perhaps he'd have a half an hour after a scheduled prison visit and he'd liaise with me and organise to visit, you know, another person in an isolated circumstance. And he just really went out of his way to, you know, he didn't have to do that. He could have just, you know, done his job and gone back home. But he knew that he wanted to be able to do a little bit more and be able to help every last person that he could. In fact, at the event on the beach, he was literally running around, engaging people, you know, talking to people, welcoming them, people, you know, that might have been hesitant to attend an event, to do all the ongoing things and making sure everyone feel comfortable. And then for him to be taken so horrifically, it's just beyond words.
He sounds like an incredible man and someone that you cross paths with a lot.
Yes, absolutely.
For many people, attending a synagogue is really important for Salas at this time. What about people who live in regional communities where there is no synagogue? What are you suggesting they do if they're looking for somewhere to go?
Right, that's a great question. The good thing is that the holiday that was being celebrated last night and continues to be celebrated tonight and for the rest of the week is the holiday of Hanukkah or Hanukkah. And that's something that many people are able to connect with wherever they are, to be able to light a candle. The holiday celebrates the victory of the Jewish people many years ago, but something which we continue to do today is to commemorate it by lighting up the menorah. It's an 8-branched candelabra, and each night we light an additional light. So last night was the first night of Hanukkah, and that's what was taking place in Bondi. They're having a big celebration for that. And tonight's the second night, tomorrow night's the third night, et cetera, et cetera. So being able to commemorate that and celebrate that event, you know, with people in their homes, with friends, with others, is something which, you know, everyone is really able to do wherever they are across Australia.
As you said, Rabbi, Hanukkah is all about letting in the light, isn't it? And I think the Prime Minister has urged all Australians to light a candle tonight at 6:47. Do you welcome that suggestion?
It's definitely, the world needs a lot more light, and we need physical light, people lighting candles, but we also need people to light up their own lives with kindness, with goodness, with understanding for others, and a lot of respect and learning. Everyone's saying a lot of change needs to happen in Australia now, and this is kind of a turning point. And that's true on many different levels, on a governmental level, on a educational level, on a personal level. But what everyone needs to be doing is ensuring that they are making a change for this, improve their personal conduct, improve their interactions with their friends, with others, with strangers. Because we can't just, you know, push to the wayside and say, oh, you know, the government's going to deal with this, the higher ups are going to deal with this, or, you know, maybe the Jewish community will figure this out, but everyone else can kind of just sit idly on the side. This is something which really every Australian and anyone in this country really needs to be doing something about and taking to heart to ensure that something like this never happens again.
Earlier this year, the Special Envoy's plan to combat anti-Semitism spoke about the urgency of addressing troubling levels of anti-Semitism in Australia. Did you have your own concerns then?
It's been a concerning situation for a long time now. This has been ongoing for quite a while. You know, for it to come to something like this is absolutely horrific. A lot of recommendations have been put into place, which really do hope the government does adopt them and take them up. But as I mentioned before, you know, the government is one team of people, but there's a lot of other people in this country also, which you know, each and every one of us, which needs to be taking action in regards to all this.
Rabbi, do you worry that this could cause people in your community to leave Australia because they fear for their safety?
People are definitely worried. People are concerned. I can't tell you what people are going to make, what decisions they're going to make on an individual level. You know, if that was on someone's mind, that may be something which would come more to the forefront of their mind. I would really like to hope. I mean, I'm planning on staying here. I've still got a lot of work to do, reaching out to people around the country and maintaining the connections that our organization has been developing for the past 25 years. I'm hoping that this is going to be something which we're going to obviously take a lot of lessons from. The lives that have lost, unfortunately, are not going to be coming back anytime soon. But at the same time, we need to be able to restore peace and harmony, which I think Australia likes to say this is a place where people get along with each other, social cohesion. It's, you know, it's a lovely country, but we're not really feeling that this second today. So that's something which really needs to be restored and put back into action.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has today reiterated that he wouldn't let anti-Semitism get a foothold in Australia. Do you think the government has done enough to stop that from happening, Rabbi?
I mean, this clearly has happened yesterday evening. That's, you know, something which should never really happened and definitely didn't need to happen. We can't change the past, but going forward, this is something which will really be taken seriously. perhaps, you know, there's only about 120,000 Jewish people in the whole of Australia. So people might think that, oh, it's just, you know, a little Jewish problem, but it's really not. It's a problem for every single person over here. If the social fabric of the country is disintegrating, then that's something which really makes a difference to every single person. And hopefully we will see the change which really needs to take place.
What should every Australian be doing today to support their Jewish fellow Australians?
So well, you just simply reach out. The silence can be deafening. You know, when something like this happens, people, you know, they know that they have close friends and they have colleagues at work and then they have a boss and they have, you know, a partner or their partner's family, whatever it might be. Just speak up, say something. You know, you can call a friend, send them a text, and buy them a coffee, whatever it is. Just show up for your Jewish friends. And you don't need to be Jewish to say something about this situation. You don't need to say, hey, well, the Jewish people probably have their Jewish friends, so then the Jewish friends are going to take care of this. This is an opportunity, incredible opportunity to show support, show solidarity, which is something which is spoken about a lot. And today's the day to actually do that. Today's the day to make that happen.
Rabbi Aaron, thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
Appreciate it. You be well and take care.
You too.
ABC Australia Wide.
Rabbi Aaron, who's from a community organisation, Chabad, that offers outreach to Jewish communities in rural and regional Australia. You're listening to Australia Wide with me, Sinead Mangan. Lovely to have your company today. Now to other news happening across regional Australia. WA's North is on Asia's doorstep, a closeness that's helped build a major economic relationship. But to get to Asia from the resource-rich Pilbara, locals have to fly thousands of kilometres in the other direction to Perth. That could soon change, with one town hoping it can bring international flights to the region. Kimberly Putland has this story.
From Karratha, the only regular ticket you can get will send you to Perth, some 1,400 kilometres south. But locals could soon find themselves jetting off to more exotic places after a renewed push to upgrade the regional city's airport into an international one. Karratha first made a bid for an international airport after upgrades around a decade ago. But now the government has confirmed it received the application, and City of Karratha CEO Virginia Miltrop is optimistic.
So what we've done is we've worked with EY, and a consulting company, to pull together a really compelling business case that explains to the federal government why they should make the Karratha Airport an international port.
It's no secret that regional international travel has struggled in recent years after Port Hedland's Bali service collapsed during COVID and the Broome-Singapore route stopped earlier this year. It's something Hayley Vale, CEO of Port Hedland International Airport, is all too familiar with.
We did obviously have a service and had it for around 25 years through various airlines over the time. That serviced Port Hedland to Denpasar up in Bali. Unfortunately, when COVID reared its ugly head, we did lose that service.
Since COVID, Port Hedland has struggled to get commercial international flights off the ground again.
It is difficult. Obviously, we are lucky that we have an Australian Border Force and a biosecurity staffing base here supporting the Port of Port Hedland. However, that is their primary focus.
Despite the challenges faced by Port Hedland, the City of Karratha says there is a strong case for both locals travelling abroad and inbound internationals who want to see the Pilbara.
There's a lot of people coming through for business purposes because we're such an economic engine here. The other thing is it definitely is locals wanting to go on holidays. So it is both inbound and outbound. With the World Heritage listing of Murujuga, we would be expecting that we'll be getting a lot more tourist activity as well.
While the city remains optimistic, flights won't be off the ground for at least a few years.
I would be saying as soon as possible. But look, if we're talking about 18 months before we get a decision, so you're going to be talking a few years at least. But rest assured, it's actually at the very top of our agenda, so it'll happen as soon as we can possibly make it happen.
The Department of Infrastructure confirmed it had received the city's application and said it was pursuing increased opportunities for international airline markets in line with the government's aviation white paper. A spokesperson told the ABC the application was being considered in consultation with other agencies responsible for aviation safety, security, air navigation, and border and biosecurity services. While the department Department noted it had not received any applications from airlines to operate to Karratha, locals were keen to see an international airport take off.
Yeah, so if we have an international flight happening in Karratha, not only save the money but also save our life trouble with the young kids.
Oh, that'd be a great idea.
I think they should start with domestic flights first.
Every time when I go to Thailand, I have to go Karratha, Perth, Singapore, Taiwan.
Japan, I'd love to go to.
New Zealand, being a New Zealander myself.
Amsterdam, Bali.
The wish list of many people in Karratha. That was Kimberly Putland reporting from the Pilbara region in Western Australia. They were blasted in their waterholes with gelignite, overfished and fed to pigs. Decimated by human impacts, including habitat destruction, Mary River cod numbers dipped as low as 600 in the wild. But as Jennifer Nichols reports, a 25-year-old recovery action plan for one of Australia's most endangered freshwater species is being updated. And people's passion for the cod may save it.
Diving into his dams, Darren Knowles knows that the territorial male Mary River cod he's about to encounter won't welcome him.
To see one of them under the water and come out of a mud cloud at you, yeah, it's quite scary, and I found it's pretty hard to scream when you're under the water.
In breeding season, male cod rush from nests in large plastic pipes to defend the eggs that Mr. Knowles needs to transfer to tanks at his Noosa hinterland hatchery.
You don't have any extremities exposed. You have your toes dug into the mud and your fingers in a fist.
Fierce large fish have even dislodged his face mask.
You end up coughing and choking and coming to the surface.
Darren Knowles is committed to helping save one of Australia's most endangered freshwater species from extinction. His hatchery is helping restock Queensland's Mary River and its tributaries, where the largest cod on record was 120 centimetres long and weighed almost 40 kilograms.
These species were so abundant at some point they were used as pig feed. At some point in history we were fishing for them with sticks of gelignite.
Tom Espinosa is the CEO of the Burnett Mary Regional Group, or BMRG. He says overfishing and habitat destruction decimated the species.
The Mary River Cod Recovery Plan that was produced in the late 90s had a specific section in there that estimated that there was probably about 600 individuals left of this species.
Stretching from its headwaters in the Sunshine Coast hinterland to the ocean just south of Hervey Bay, the 291-kilometre-long Mary River is the fourth highest contributor of sediment to the Great Barrier Reef. Outdated government advice instructed farmers to de-snag waterways, removing hollow logs and log jams crucial for cod nesting. River and creek banks were stripped of trees that stabilised soils and shaded and cooled the water. Erosion has filled what were once deep water holes.
I know what my mission is. I need to get something done.
Tom Espinosa organised a two-day workshop at Darren Knowles' hatchery, bringing together traditional owners, recreational fishing and natural resource management groups, Murray River cod conservation experts from interstate, hatchery owners and scientists. The plan is to update the 25-year-old Mary River Cod Recovery Action Plan with a team approach to research and seeking funding.
We've had forums in 2012 and 2019 and we're still talking about the same things and asking for the same actions and management interventions. So for my part, I think it's about getting something done, so my focus will be on that.
Some gains are already being made. There's now a total fishing ban during August, September and October in the Upper Mary River and its tributaries to better stop protected cod being accidentally caught during their breeding season. Genetic testing will help guide where wild broodstock should be sourced to minimise inbreeding. The Mary River Catchment Coordinating Committee, or MRCCC, and BMRG have helped landowners install pile fields at some of the Mary River's worst erosion sites. It involves driving rows of 6-metre-long timber poles into lower slopes to slow the water flow during flooding. Riverbanks have been reshaped and replanted to prevent huge chunks of land from being washed away.
It's nice to see that this is snowballing and we're sort of collecting other organisations as we go along and others are trying to contribute to this initiative.
Luke Carpenter-Bundu from Griffith University is one of the scientists involved in evaluating an MRCCC project that placed hollowed-out logs in the river for cod nesting. It was a success.
It's great that we're not having to source materials on our own anymore. We're having help with that, carving out the logs. Jinnabara and Cubby Cubby are involved now, also carving out these logs and helping us deploy them.
Many challenges lie ahead for the Mary River cod, but even with limited restocking, hatchery owner Darren Knowles is feeling hopeful.
We're starting to see some anecdotal results and some research-driven results that the numbers are starting to stabilise and even starting to come back in certain areas. I think there's a pretty bright future for them as long as we take some really important steps.
Thanks to Jennifer Nichols for that story. Let's head now to Laurton on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, where a few years ago, Graham Lee and a group of mates were enjoying a cuppa when they decided to donate the price of a coffee each week to local charities. Graham had previously lived on the street and wanted to do something to give back. A registered charity now, the $5 Coffee Club, was born and has since donated about $40,000 to charities and those in need. The Laurton Group recently started also running coffee, cake and chat sessions to help those facing social isolation and loneliness. Emma Seosian went along to find out more.
Do you want some milk or some sugar?
No, some milk, thanks. That'd be great.
I'll just wait for that.
On a large lawn under the shade of gum trees, a group of people are chatting over cake and coffee. Most of them haven't met each other before, and they're taking part in a new initiative run by a charity here at Laurton on the New South Wales mid-north coast, known as the $5 Coffee Club.
Loneliness and trying to engage with people in community is just so important to get them out of their houses, and that's what we've got going at the moment.
The social afternoons are run on the grounds at the local Camden Haven Anglican Church. Brian Giles Brown is on the charity's committee. He says they saw a need in the community for more opportunities for people to connect socially.
So we're here at one of the Monday afternoon coffee, cake and chats.
Yep.
There's a nice crowd here. It's a sunny afternoon. So beautiful. Why are these sessions important?
We live in a shire that's got one of the largest retiree populations in New South Wales, and also a lot of those retirees are living in over 55 resorts and other retiree communities, and we know that so many of them are hermitising. I just made that word up. We lived in Laurton Resort when we first moved up here, and we know that there were at least 50, mainly women, who were living by themselves and you virtually never saw them. It's dynamic, it'll grow.
Well, why don't we walk over to the afternoon tea table and I'll meet some of the coffee chatters.
What treats are on the menu today?
Oh, yes. Well, we've got a caramel slice out there. And we do have some cupcakes, some chicken and dill with celery sandwiches, if you would like to have something like that.
Donna Giles Brown. I'm the cook and I go into my recipe book and pull out all sorts of recipes and try to do something different. So we just decided to start it up as to bring people into the from the community who may not have family and they just want to come and have a cup of tea and have a chit chat.
Linda here has just started this. I came today.
You know, I came today because I thought, well, you know, you can be with your partner at home, but it's nice to have a change of scenery and to mix with different people. So I thought, no, come along and get to know some other people.
Tom Binks is also enjoying the chance to meet new people.
We're relatively new to this district and have no family close by, and we just thought we'd come down and spend time with other people with the same in the same situation or are lonely. It's been good to catch up with people.
Nathan Killick, and I'm the senior minister here. I think that people need somewhere to go because we are living in what has been termed plenty of times as a loneliness epidemic, and this opportunity is just a great opportunity to use what we've got to be able to connect with people.
The $5 Coffee Club was the brainchild of Graham Lee, a local who was chatting with a few mates at Laurton when the idea came up.
A couple of mates sitting around having a coffee in the end of 2021.
I suggested we look at ways of supporting the community, charities and that. So I said, look, if we drink 10 cups of coffee a week, drink 9 and put $5 in a tin. And that's how it started. And since 2022, we've been able to give over $40,000 to charities, palliative care, cancer trust, people in need on the street. The main goal of the coffee club is that $5, if people could donate that once a week, and our goal is 1,000 people doing that a week.
Graham first became inspired to help others after falling on hard times himself.
I lived on the street for 4 years. Lost a substantial business. Well, didn't lose a substantial business. I hibernated it. Went through a bit of a rough trot. Lost my house and my family. And I was on the street and got involved with the homeless in Port. It's better to give than receive. There's a guy sitting here across the table. He was in a really bad spot about 2 months ago. Now he's got accommodation and doing real well. So good to see.
Emma Ossian reporting from the New South Wales Mid-North Coast. A small town bakery is the jewel of many main streets across Australia. But for the last couple of years, one central Queensland bakery has been shut as the family owners have navigated a dementia diagnosis for their much-loved baker. But they want you to know the pies at Snow's Bakery are back. And as Hannah Walsh reports from Alpha, that they're so happy they're singing about it.
When he got dropped off in Shakespeare Street, he looked the driver in the eye and he said, "Thanks, mate, I've travelled all this way. Taste an Alpha pie."
They say in its heyday, the pies and sweet treats at Snow's reeled in travellers off Central Queensland's Capricorn Highway.
"We've planned this trip for years to taste an Alpha pie."
We made a lot of pies here once. At least 100 every day.
100 every day?
Yeah.
And the rest.
For most of his life, Chris Tills has woken long before dawn and kneaded dough. The rhythmic whirring of a mixer and comforting smell of yeast and sugar have kept him company.
Maybe 400 some days.
400, yeah.
A lot of people come here.
But slowly Chris's memory has started to falter. Recipes he knew by heart were harder to remember.
His health turned a bit for the worse about 3 years ago. And first things first, we had to try and sort of get his health in order before we could do anything with the business. And that kept us all pretty busy.
That's his younger brother, Peter. The recipes were passed down from their dad, so Peter noticed when they didn't taste quite right.
So it's gradual, so we didn't sort of realise that it was happening until just things weren't quite right, things were forgotten, that sort of thing.
But ultimately, Chris was diagnosed with dementia.
We didn't enjoy seeing what was happening to Christopher and his livelihood and the business. With the way his condition is, he just forgot to come down some days.
So 2 years ago, the doors to Chris's bakery, Snow's Bakery in Alpha, were pulled shut and the ovens turned off.
I mean, it's been such a big part of Chris's life and the family. We really sort of anchored to it because it's been a great, almost like a household name, so to speak, and around the West End, around Queensland.
Baking runs in the Tills brothers' blood, so Peter made the decision that he'd take over the operational duties under the guidance of Chris.
None of us wanted to see it go. Just in the last 3 or 4 months, I've been in a position where I could try and do something and bring the pies back.
The goods are being sold down the road at Peter's old-time music and food hall. And while baking runs in the family's blood, the craft came about from hardship.
In 1945, my late aunt, my father's sister, she was married to the baker up there at Mareeba during the war. She got run over by a US Army truck. Mm. Story, as I know it, what happened was after that, her husband sort of, family, they had the bakery and it all sort of went pear-shaped for them after that. And Dad's older brothers took it over and then Dad got into the trade that way.
Eventually their dad, Monty Tills, or Snow, as he was referred to because of his white hair as a young lad, came to Alpha and opened Snow's Bakery.
Well, I've had people, you know, who've moved here, and they'll say, like, to their family, they'll go home for Christmas and say, well, you know, we've moved to Alpha, and they could be anywhere. They could be Victorians, New South Welshmen, whatever, and they'll say, well, oh, Alpha, Have you been to the bakery there?
She drove 2 hours west to Alpha. A tear was in her eye.
Peter hopes Snow's pies will satisfy hungry travellers and wants everyone to know they're open for business with the same family pie recipe that was passed down from his dad.
The real reason I started coming back down here was to try and help Chris feel like he belonged to something, so he could anchor to something and feel like himself again.
Where Snow's Bakehouse makes
pies. Pies he loves so much, he wrote a song about them.
Hannah Walsh with that story from Alpha in Queensland. And that is Australia Wide for this Monday. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.